Good evening. My name is Colette Geary. I'm the president of the College of St. Scholastica, and it is my privilege to open up this congressional forum for District 8 this evening. And I'd like to begin by extending a very warm welcome to each one of you, and especially to our panelists, the candidates. Thank you for your participation this evening. A well-informed electorate is essential for a healthy democracy. And our responsibilities as citizens require that we be fully engaged with the issues and that we contribute through our votes to shaping a future that best supports the needs of people of our community and our nation. And to do this requires that we expose ourselves to diverse perspectives and then think critically about them. And so I want to thank all those, the student leaders who were responsible for bringing this forum to us this evening. And I begin with the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group at UMD, which is headed by Mary Franz, and also the Student Senate at St. Scholastica, which is under the capable governance of President Jason Chavez and his team. Thank you to both of them. And finally, I want to thank the moderators who are going to help us make the most effective use of the opportunities that we have this evening, and that is Dr. Tom Morgan and Dr. Jennifer Moore. Thank you so much.
My name is Jason Chavez, and I am the student body president here at the College of St. Scholastica. We want to thank each and every single person that has attended this forum today. This event was student organized and student led by many students here, so if we can give every single student here a round of applause, that would be great. It has been a great honor to be one of the co-organizers of this event that brings a lot of people here together, as long as the community as well. It's great because it gets everybody here more involved in the political system that gives an impact in everybody's lives. This is the first time that all 8th Congressional District candidates from all three different parties are here together to talk to us all. And we just want to give a special thank you to MPERG, the Marketing Department, St. Scholastica History and Politics Department, and the UMD Political Science Department here at St. Scholastica and UMD. So if you can give all those people a warm welcome, they made this event possible today. And I would now like to introduce Mary Franz from MPERG. She is another co-organizer of this event, and MPERG has done a lot as well. So if you can just welcome her today.
Hello, everyone. My name is Mary Franz. I go by she, her, hers. I'm a woman that wears many hats in the community, one of which is the directing organizer of MPERG at the University of Minnesota Duluth, as well as the CLA senator at the University of Minnesota Duluth as well. And on behalf of both Student Association and MPERG, it has been a great honor to work hand in hand with the academic community around Duluth to present this event for you all tonight. We deeply appreciate and want to recognize our sponsors here tonight. So we have UMD Student Association, Mighty Indivisible CD8, UMD YDSA, Duluth for Clean Water, Advocates for Choice, College Republicans, Our Revolution, College Dems, Bulldog Students for Life, and Allworth Center for Study of Peace and Justice, as well as the UMD Political Science Department and St. Scholastica History and Political Department. I also want to deeply appreciate Dr. Thomas Morgan and Jennifer Moore, the moderators of tonight's event, as well as Malachi Coons, the timekeeper. So without further ado, let's let the event begin.
Good evening, everybody. I'm the Tom Morgan one. The questions that Dr. Moore and I are going to be asking have been submitted prior to the event. A booth outside the auditorium has a table where additional questions can be submitted. The questions will be reviewed in order to avoid partisanship, slander, derogatory terminology, and so forth. Every candidate will have a minute and a half to introduce themselves. For general questions, each candidate will have a minute and a half to respond to each question that Dr. Moore and I ask. And for directed questions, if a candidate in particular was mentioned in a response to a previous question, that candidate will have 1 minute to respond and make a rebuttal. And at the closing of this event, each candidate will have 1 minute to make a closing statement. One other thing I should say is that This is Minnesota. We're nice here. We're civilized. So we ask you to keep your applause to yourself until the conclusion of the event. No shouting, booing, cheering, nothing like that to disturb the solemnity of the event, and no flash cameras. Of course, newspaper and TV is accepted to that. I think those are the rules of the game, and you all understand them, the candidates. So let me hand the microphone over to my colleague, Dr. Jennifer Moore, who will ask the first question.
Hi, good evening. It's a delight to be here. And I think what we'll start with is we'll have all of the candidates introduce themselves, and we will start to our left, your right, with Ray Skip Sandman, and then continue this way, please.
I lived in the 8th Congressional District here for 50 years plus, and I've talked with a lot of people about some of the issues that are facing the 8th Congressional District. I'm a military Vietnam veteran with two tours, a retired corrections officer, and also as a traditional healer in a Native community. And I'm very proud to be here tonight, and I wish everybody well here, and I want to thank for St. Scholastica for inviting me up here so that I can share some of my views with you. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is Pete Stauber, and I am the Republican running for this congressional seat. I grew up in Duluth. I have been married 22 years to my wife, Jody. We have four teenage kids, and I just retired from the Duluth Police Department after serving 22 years, 23 total. I started out as a police officer paramedic in the city of Cottage Grove, Minnesota, came up to Duluth, spent the last 22 years serving in numerous capacities, from a patrol officer to a neighborhood officer to patrol sergeant, patrol lieutenant, training lieutenant, tactical response team member. It's a great career. Currently in my second term as a St. Louis County Commissioner after having served 8 years on the Hermantown City Council. My wife Jody is an Iraq War veteran, and she is the first female command chief at the 148th Fighter Wing here in Duluth. I really appreciate this opportunity to be here today, and to the kids, young folks that put this on. This is really impressive thus far, and I look forward to the debate. Thank you.
I thank the organizers of tonight's debate for this opportunity, and I thank those of you in the audience who have decided to participate tonight. My name is Michelle Lee, and I want to be your first Congresswoman in Washington. For more than 30 years, I reported on the impact the decisions made in St. Paul and in Washington had on our friends and neighbors, decisions both good and bad. The night Donald Trump won the election, I was on the anchor desk. His election was like a kick in the gut. I know many of you here tonight feel the same way. Well, that was then, this is now. I left the anchor desk behind and headed to the Women's March in Washington. It felt good to be on the front lines. I was raised in a family of seven kids. I know about being poor. I was that little girl who walked to school with holes in my shoes. I scraped plates in the school cafeteria to get a free lunch. Had it not been for a caring teacher, I probably wouldn't be sitting here today. My mission is this, to pay it forward. And we can move forward together by providing free education to those who want it, by providing a healthcare system that doesn't drive people into bankruptcy, by building an infrastructure that isn't compared to that of a third world, by providing the support necessary to support those who serve to protect us in America and across the world. And we must protect our environment in the face of multinational corporations that put profits ahead of people. I hope by the end of this evening I will have provided you the answers you need to consider me as your next Congresswoman in Washington. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Leah Pfeiffer, and I am seeking the DFL endorsement to represent the 8th Congressional District. First off, thank you so much to the students and organizers who put together this fantastic forum. I am so pleased to be here tonight. I grew up just down the road in Two Harbors. I come from four generations of men who worked in the taconite mining industry and four generations of women who ran small businesses from Isandy to Virginia. I, however, did not go into small business or into mining. I spent the last 10 years working in various capacities capacities in our federal government through Homeland Security, the USDA, and lastly, the FBI. And after 10 years of carrying out laws written by Congress, I have seen a growing gulf between those who write the laws and those who are affected by these laws. I am seeking the DFL endorsement so that I can go on to Congress to write better laws than the ones that I carried out over the past decade. Thank you again for being here tonight, to everyone who's able to join us, and I'm grateful for you all to be here.
Good evening. I'm Kirsten Kennedy. I am so grateful to be here tonight. I am a Norwegian-born American. I am a military child and a military wife. I'm also a single mom of five children from North Branch, Minnesota, the very southern end of our district, almost the southernest point. I am so grateful at 45 after my divorce that I was able to obtain an education. I completed a BS in psychology from the University of Minnesota, Duluth, and then went on to finish my master's in advocacy and political leadership through the University of Minnesota, Duluth. I am grateful to be a community organizer and take that community organizing to run for a contested seat, a hotly contested seat for mayor in North Branch. I won by 60% of the vote my first time and 58% the second time. We've done a lot of great things in our region. I also work for the Statewide Health Improvement Partnership. I work on the reduction of obesity and tobacco use, farm to fork, sustainable farming, and I work on dementia and senior issues. I am so grateful to be here tonight. I am so grateful to run for offices that I believe in, that I believe I can make a difference in, and I just want to be clear about why I'm running. I'm running for my gay brother who was beat up in L.A. in the 80s. I'm running for all of the people I loved that died of AIDS. I'm running for my mothers and my sisters and those suffering. I am running for every single person, the 800,000 people that live in our district. I appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Greetings, everyone, and again, thank you to the organizers who put on this event. My name is Joe Radinovich, and for me, politics has always been about the community I come from and the people I care about. I got involved in politics for the first time when I was an eighth grader, when I went to my local school board meeting. In Crosby-Arrington, for the first time, we had proposed deep budget cuts. And when you come from a small town, those budget cuts are not in the abstract. Those are your teachers, they are your friends' parents, they're your church members, they're people in your community who care about you and who support you. I thought it was unfair that a small town where 59% of the students were on free and reduced lunch would suffer such deep cuts. And that night, 500 people showed up to the school board meeting. They went through the cuts they included at the late bus and sports programs and vocational training and arts classes and gifted and rich programs. And right on down the line, the school board had no option but to pass those cuts. That same meeting happened every year for 10 years, and I swore that if I could, I'd do something about it. And so when I turned 25, there was an open seat in the legislature, and I declared my candidacy. I was elected to the State House at 26, where I went down and fought on behalf of rural education, making sure the kids in my community got opportunities that kids did in other parts of the state. But we did some other things, too. We passed all-day kindergarten. We passed the first early childhood scholarships. We passed emergency heating assistance. We also passed marriage equality, which was a difficult issue for me, because 62.5% of my district had voted to define marriages between a man and a woman. But in politics, as in life, you have to take a stand sometimes. And so in 2014, I lost my seat, but I got to keep a lot more than that because politics matters, and that's why I'm here tonight.
Well, first off, I'd like to say, Josiah, you better be being good for mom tonight. I know you two are watching this debate here. And my name is Jason Metza. I am a fifth-generation Ranger, a union organizer, a third-term legislator, a husband, and a father. And as new parents, my wife and I wondered what life was going to be like for our new son. And the only answer we could come up with is we really didn't know, and that scared us. We know we're not the only parents around this district either who are wondering what life is going to be like for their kids, and that's no way to build a strong foundation for them. It's why in the legislature I fought to raise the minimum wage, to level the playing field for women at work, and fought for paid family and medical leave for all Minnesotans. Look, folks, when you have a good job, a lot of life's little problems take care of themselves. Feeling secure and paying for the things you need, that's what really matters most. And it's what Washington should be focused on. If elected, I will fight to make sure those things are there for all of us.
All right. I'd like to remind the candidates that you have a minute and a half to answer these questions. We will be interrupting you. If you go over that minute and a half, please be mindful of your timekeeper in front of you. And we'll start with the first question. These are questions that were submitted ahead of time. And this question will start with Jason Metza. So this is an event obviously being sponsored by two institutions of higher education in the city of Duluth, the College of St. Scholastica and the University of Minnesota Duluth. How is your campaign addressing higher education and student success before and after graduation? How can we best encourage the youngest generation to attend higher education and solve the existing student debt crisis?
I believe public education has been the great equalizer in this country. And it's why in 2013 and 14 we invested and made sure that there was access for kids to the funding that they needed for that. And essentially why I also worked on the pre-K school in my district for making sure that my son could have the opportunity to go learn a little younger. And I also know that college tuition is tough. In my life, I made it through my two-year degree and couldn't quite afford to make it through a four-year degree. That's why I think two-year tuition should be free and that we need to allow students to subsidize or refinance, rather, their student loans in a four-year level. And essentially, we need to make sure kids, whether they're in college or younger, have the same opportunities everywhere, from Edina, Minneapolis, to Wadena, or St. Louis County. And if elected, I'll work to that regard to make sure the funding is adequate across the board.
Well, first, let me say that in the face of a rapidly changing economy, the students of this country shouldn't be treated as a profit center. I'll repeat that. The students in our country should not be treated as a profit center. Right now, we allow private lenders to profit off the loans they make to students, which is something that we need to discontinue. The U.S. government used to have an agreement, or there was a general social pact, that two-thirds of the tuition here in the state, in Minnesota, would be covered by the state of Minnesota. Over the years, because of misplaced priorities, we haven't kept pace with that part of our obligation. And so what we've seen is that increasingly students are left to pick up that piece of the equation. Right now, my campaign is focused on the rapid change in the economy. And I use an example that in 1980 on the Iron Range, there were about 14,500 miners producing 40 million tons of iron ore. Currently, there are about 3,900 miners producing 40 million tons of iron ore. What we're seeing is that people are being displaced by mechanization on the farms and the factories, at the grocery store, on the roads with driverless cars. And what we need to do to make sure that people are well-positioned to protect themselves and their family, to provide for themselves and their family in the future, is invest in three things. One is childcare, the other is education, and the other is healthcare. If we do those three things, then people will be well-positioned to move around in the economy, to take care of themselves and their family.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I'm Norwegian-born, and I think Norway gets it right, as do many other countries. To become and work towards having an educated class that is not burdened with debt is important and critical to the success of our nation on so many levels. I will work towards, in incremental steps, making public universities, community colleges, and vocational schools debt-free. I will work towards giving each student in the United States the chance to get an education that they desire. I will create and work towards programming that reduces student debt right now, that we refinance and we give more public options for deferment and complete dismissal of student debt. No one should have to pay for student debt and not be able to put a roof over their heads or go to the doctor or be afraid that they're going to leave debt for their children. That is not how it should be in the United States of America. Thank you.
When we discuss education, we have to start from the principle that education is a human right. Access to quality education is a human right. And every policy that I support and would push for in Congress is centered around that idea. So I would begin by making sure that human rights starts at birth. One of the best investments we can make in our children is universal all-day pre-K, making sure that we are giving children a leg up from the get-go. In my master's program, I completed my thesis on the best way to close the achievement or opportunity gap between Latino children and white children. And they found that for every dollar invested in early childhood education, you get a $14 return on that investment. There is no better investment than our children. And when it comes to higher education, one of my first acts in Congress would be to sign on to Bernie Sanders' College for All Act to make sure that we are providing 4-year tuition-free education at public universities, 2-year free tuition at all community colleges, allowing existing loan borrowers to refinance at much lower rates. And if anyone has to take out loans, make sure that those loans are also being issued at very, very low rates. So we are not crippling our children and our future with the crushing debt that many of us are currently under.
For the past 15 years or more, we have been sending our young people off to war, rather than spending our tax dollars on educating our future workers. I will support any effort when I become your congresswoman that we truly have free education for VOTEX and our public institutions. I look back in 2008 when we had the start of a recession. The government stepped up. We bailed out the banks. We bailed out big businesses. It's time that we consider bailing out all of our workers who are struggling under the debt, the heavy debt of student loans. I recently talked to a woman who is 60 years old. She said she still has student debt. She had a midlife change in her education, training, and her concern is that she might not be able to live on her Social Security because she's still paying a heavy student loan. And I've talked to kids that were caught up in that 2008 recession. They weren't the first ones hired, and they are the last being hired today. These kids are frozen in time. They're making a decision now to not get married, not have children, not buy homes. If we can come up with a way of giving them a banker's holiday, just think what that would have the impact on our economy. They would be out buying cars. They'd be buying homes. They would be buying refrigerators. They'd be holding good jobs, $15 an hour jobs, and they would help move this economy along. We really have to get this right. We have to get serious. We have to start providing free education. Thank you.
In 1956, a young woman by the name of Jean Peterson graduated from St. Scholastica with a degree in medical records administration. Jean Peterson met a guy by the name of Del Stauber. My mother and father raised 6 of us on the St. Scholastica education. I understand how important higher ed is. I understand that we have to compete with technology, the mathematics, the sciences. We have to compete on the global stage, and I think we can. One of the things we're looking at is on the average student today has and the graduated student has $37,000 of debt. I can't comprehend that when you graduate with that amount of debt. How do you get started in life? For me, I told my sons, my wife served at the 148th. I served as a police officer, middle income family. I told my kids, I said, Mom and Dad don't make enough money. We don't have the Roth IRA, the education IRA. Here's what my wife and I tell our children. You are going to earn an academic scholarship. You will earn an athletic scholarship, or you will serve your country like your mother did and use the GI Bill to be able to gain a good education and a 4-year degree. But we also have to remember we have secondary technical colleges, 2-year university or 2-year associate degrees. We can make great money with our hands, and we can't forget that.
Our future is within the youth. Our future for success for the United States of America lies with our education. When I'm elected to Congress, I will put forth a bill that will take care of the education and rally other individuals there to push forward for free education 4 years, or and also technical schools. Time has come that we cannot saddle our youth with horrendous debt. Therefore, for our future in success to succeed, I would also put forward that all student debt is forgiven. They can do that for the big corporations. Why can't they do it for our children, our future? Because everything depends on our future, and that is our children with the education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And here's question number two, and we'll start with Mr. Radinovich with his question. In light of the recent mass shootings at a high school in Parkland, Florida, as a representative in the U.S. House, what will you do to help prevent more incidents like this from happening in the future?
Yeah, this is a really important question, especially now. I just want to say that gun violence is an epidemic in this country, and it's impacted my life in a very personal way. Right now, there are roughly about 33,000 gun deaths per year in this country, and about 60% of them are suicides, or 60-plus percent, and about the remaining 35 or 40% are homicides. And in my life, both of those things have been very real. When I was a junior in high school, I came home from track practice, I opened the door, and I heard a gunshot. And I ran into the kitchen, and a family member had tried to kill himself. And I lifted his legs so he wouldn't go into shock. And I sat and I waited. We lived 4 miles out of the country while 911 came. And I prayed that my little brother wouldn't die in my arms that day. And I thought that was the worst thing that was going to happen to me, sitting in the hospital with him for a month after that. Until 11 months later, my mother was shot and killed, murdered in my kitchen by a family member, who then killed himself outside. And so I understand very well the impact of gun violence. And what we're looking at today needs to be addressed. And I think that we need to address it by providing additional mental health services, by making sure that students feel safe in the schools that they're at. But very specifically, I think we also need to ban bump stocks and high-capacity magazines. I think we need to raise the age of purchase on those rifles to 21. I think we need to pass universal background checks. And I think we need to do it today. We can't see more carnage like we've seen in Las Vegas, in Florida, and in Connecticut, and in other places. And if we don't act now, then we're going to continue to see more of it.
Thank you so much. This also hits close to home for me. As the mayor of North Branch 2 weeks ago, I got a phone call from our police chief that a young man had made threats against the school to use guns against fellow students. I have a ninth grader at school, and at first I said, Abraham, I'm the mayor, you're going to school. And he said, what if something happens to me? And you know what? I took a breath and I thought, what if something happens to him? We had millions of people march yesterday. We had children standing up and saying the truth when a bunch of adults can't make a decision. The CDC has not been able to look at gun deaths since the late 90s. We have shootings happening in our schools and on our streets. And as an adult, as a mom of five children, we have to get this right. We need universal background checks. We need to fund the CDC. Not just say the CDC can do the work, but actually fund it so we can get real statistics on gun deaths and have a real debate about it. We need to have machines of war not available on our streets or with our citizens. We have a responsibility to get this right, and I'm telling you right now, the countries and the states that have really strict gun safety legislation do not see the violence that we see right now. So I'm asking you, as an adult, to join me. Thank you.
Gun violence in this country is absolutely a public health crisis. And as Kirsten mentioned, the CDC has not been allowed to study this public health crisis. So we, as members of Congress, need to immediately begin to restore that funding so that we can study the gun violence in this country and apply common sense solutions. This is an area where we can find common ground between Democrats and Republicans, though it may not seem like it. Everyone can agree that our children should be in school learning and growing, not preparing for mass shootings. Even conservative leaders like Ronald Reagan and Justice Scalia agree there is no constitutional right for citizens to have assault rifles and military-grade weapons. Many Americans agree, the majority of Americans agree, that we need enhanced background investigations. I'm a gun owner. I know many gun owners who support these common sense solutions. And we need to start immediately on finding these bipartisan areas where we can get started.
America's children brought the world together once again yesterday. Millions marched to demand common sense gun legislation. I, as nearly 50% of this panel, have had a personal impact as a result of gun violence. My brother, when I was a teenager, was shot and killed in an alcohol-fueled argument, a family argument. It was tragic, but that's my story. I know there's thousands of other stories of people possibly right here in this room today that have felt the anguish, the pain that gun violence can bring. I, too, am a responsible gun owner, but I came out early in this race demanding that we ban bump stocks, high-capacity magazines, noise suppressors, and I will continue to state that military assault-style weapons should be in the hands of those sworn to protect us, not in the hands of those who choose to harm us. Thoughts and prayers are no longer enough. We need to take action. We need to start coming together to build legislation that is truly legislation for gun reform. When over 300 million guns are now in private hands in America, I think we have to bring those people together to come up with responsible solutions so that we will not see the wholesale slaughter of our children. I, for one, am sick and tired of it. We cannot wait a minute longer. We have to address this problem, and soon. Our kids are leading us. We need to follow where they lead.
The Parkland shooting, no doubt, was a travesty, and every school shooting is a travesty. The workplace, the schools need to be safe environments, not only for the workers, but the students. And what we're seeing is, in Parkland specifically, because that's what it was asked, the police were called to that young boy's house 29 times. The FBI was alerted 2 times. Psychologists stated that the individual was not a harm to himself or others. I think that we need school resource officers in every school. In the city of Duluth, we have them, and they're very effective. I also think we need to ensure that anybody that's going through a mental health crisis or drug addiction, they need help, and they should not have a handgun or a weapon if they're in crisis. One of the problems we have in this country is, in Duluth, Minnesota, if I lodged to somebody on a mental health crisis, a 72-hour hold, they got out of the 72-hour hold and they drove to the state of Ohio to purchase a handgun. There was no records of it. We need across the board, across the country, records that we can attain on folks that are in mental health crisis or addicted to drugs. There is not any law-abiding gun owner that I know that wants a criminal, an opioid addict, drug addict, or a alcoholic with a weapon in their hand.
What we need to do in this country is stop the NRA from giving the money to the politicians. And the politicians that are in office right now need to stop accepting that money. There doesn't need to be another law made. There doesn't need all these big discussions. We need our Congress to just reinstate the 1994 assault weapons ban and machine pistols, magazines. We need that reinstatement and And in that band that's already out there, that is already a law, is take care of the sunset clause that's in there. If you look at through history, When that ban that came out in 1994, only one school shooting, and that was Columbine, and that was two shooters with 13 victims. But as soon as the ban in 2004, when the Sunset Clause came in, your mass shootings went up two or three times as high. We need in this country is to start taking this big money out of our politicians' pockets. I will push forward when I'm elected to reinstate this ban. Thank you.
Well, I think we've gotten too far away from the idea that everyone should be able to feel safe and secure in this country. I truly believe that that is a right we have living here. And when I was 16, I lived up in Alaska, was in a little town called Healy, and I was on the student government up there, where one of the first school shootings happened in this country. The whole state banded together. At that point, we were able to have a 22 in our lockers, and someone used it the wrong way. So we got to smarten up with these laws and make sure that kids aren't in a position in a school where they don't feel safe. The response from the NRA to say that teachers should be armed was stupid. And it's why in my second and third term, I quit filling out their questionnaires for the office I'm running for. We need to make sure that we're investing in the criminal background checks that are needed to go across state lines so that a domestic abuser in Wisconsin or Louisiana cannot move to Minnesota and purchase a weapon because our databases don't talk to one another. It's why, if I'm elected, I'll make sure that we put the funding and resources into those to make sure that we do have a true universal background check system that works to keep weapons out of the hands of people who don't deserve to have them.
All right, we'll start with Kristen Kennedy with this question. What does immigration reform mean to you, and how would you balance national security and privacy?
This is also a personal issue for me, and frankly, unless you're an indigenous person, thank you, Mr. Sandman, we are all immigrants in this country. My father was an immigrant from Norway. I know that President Trump recently said that he wants a lot more Norwegians here. I want you to know that my family called and they don't want to come. Let's stop talking about immigration reform like it's something dirty. Right now in Tijuana, we have people that have served this country that by no issue except where they were born are they sent to a place where they don't even speak the language. We have ICE making money off of private prisons to put families, mothers, and children into jail and deport them. Let's be clear that immigration reform should have already been voted on. We have millions of people that should already be American citizens. National security, how about we try diplomacy instead of eternal wars? How about we work on infrastructure instead of building walls? And how about we honor the United States of America by inviting immigrants in? Let's also be clear that the terrorism in the United States is not the majority from people from other countries. It's from Caucasian Americans right on our soil.
Immigration reform is one of those intractable issues that has driven me to run for Congress. I studied Spanish in college, and in 2008, I was hired by Immigration and Customs Enforcement to translate for undocumented immigrants navigating deportation proceedings. And for 6 years, I saw the corrosive effects of Congress's unwillingness to enact true immigration reform. In 2012, I was there when President Obama signed the order we now know as DACA. And while many people celebrated on that day, I had a pit in my stomach because I knew that DACA was not law, it was an executive order. And if the next president wanted to overturn it, they could. And guess what happened? We still don't have a solution for the nearly 1 million dreamers in this country. As public opinion gets more and more frustrated with Congress's inability or unwillingness to tackle these issues, we shift our focus to those carrying out the laws. We need to keep our focus and our pressure strongly on Congress to make sure we pass the lasting immigration reform we need for the 1 million dreamers living in this country, but also for the 10 million other undocumented immigrants who are living in the shadows. I strongly support a pathway to citizenship for all those who have been living peacefully in this country and call it home, and it will be one of my top priorities in Congress.
First, I'd like to address the Dreamers issue. These kids, these young adults, are as American as my own son, Fred. We need to provide them with a very rapid pathway to become American citizens. End of discussion. We have been leading them along. Just think how difficult it is to be a young person who have, you spent most of your life here in America. You've gone through our educational system, and then to have this carrot leading you along, a carrot on a stick saying you will become an American citizen, and have that stick yanked away from you month after month, depending on the administration in control. They need a pathway, and that pathway needs to be created today. They need to earn their citizenship. They've already earned it. They need to get it. I think about my great-grandmother, Ginny Lee, who came across from Sweden as a young girl with her mom and dad. All she had was a wicker basket with her worldly possessions on, and how frightening they must have felt coming into Ellis Island and settling down by Fish Lake in Harris, Minnesota, to eke out a living on a very small farm. That farm helped to support two generations of my family. They were good people. They came here without an education, without millions of dollars, but they integrated, they became good Americans, and I'm here today because they did that. And I think every good person that wants to come here and build America like many of our ancestors should be allowed in. We have the processes in place to make this happen and make it done safely. So I think we just need to open our arms like they did many, many years ago at Ellis Island. Thank you.
I support legal immigration where the immigrant wants to come to this great country, live our American dream, and contribute to our society. My press secretary is Caroline Tarwid. She's a first-generation immigrant from Poland. Her mom and dad immigrated from the country of Poland. Her father is a tile setter in the city of Chicago. That's the type of immigrant I think we all want, somebody that wants to come here and contribute, be successful, work, and live the American dream. We also know that our biggest immigration violators are the overextension and stay of the visas and the student visas, the work visas, etc. So once we get a handle on that, I think that we have the ability to have an immigration system that allows people to come here legally. And when we do that, we know exactly how many immigrants are coming in. And I certainly am very supportive of legal immigration. I also support building the wall on our southern border. It is going to stop illegal immigrants. It is going to stop drugs flowing freely through the border. And it's also going to stop human trafficking. Thousands and thousands of young people are being trafficked across that border.
Immigration. Well, well, now that the door is open, I believe and I feel that what's made this country great is our immigration. I believe that building that wall down there is a waste of time and money, because if a person really wants to get to this country, they're going to get to this country. A $20 billion wall or whatever the price is, that money can be redirected into other social programs that we desperately need as people. The DECA kids, They should be saying, why do they have to jump through hoops? Why not just make them citizens? And that immigration form and that immigration package, you take a look at that, they're charging them $800 to take a test. Why? When you look at your ancestries of where you come from, were you charged $800 to step off in Ellis Island? Why is it? And if they want to build a wall in the southern border, why not one? Because you can't trust those Canadians either. Let's be real with immigration. Those DACA kids had no choice. They came with their parents. They're here, they're producing, they're paying a lot of taxes. Why not just say, hey, let's make America great.
That might let's be a take good time away, to stop. Sorry, I have to stop you. Very unpopular, I'm sure, with the crowd, considering your last, thank you.
America was built on immigration. And unless you're Native American, all of you come from family of immigrants. And, you know, for my family, my great-grandfather came over from Italy when he was 15. And I'm pretty sure that he did not have the documentation he needed to be a citizen here. But he worked hard and started his own family, started a little shop, and ended up with me down the road. So at the end of the day, what we really need to be focused on here is not chasing people out of their communities when their only crime is being here. In Congress, we need to be making sure that kids came in unknowingly, have access to stay and contribute in the country they call home. And if I'm elected, I'll work to make sure that that happens.
Immigration reform means, I think, recognizing the inherent humanity of all of the people in this world, all the people in this country. To me, immigration reform means recognizing our own immigrant stories and considering the experience of those who have recently arrived in our country. Immigration reform starts with a pathway to citizenship, which will bring people out of the shadows of this country. There are unscrupulous people taking advantage of people in our country who are here undocumented. Some of those people are allowing labor costs to be depressed by taking advantage of those workers. Some of those workers have to go to check cashing joints and to payday lenders to do their banking, making them targets for people who would rob them because they're carrying large sums of cash. Those same immigrants are afraid to oftentimes report those crimes to the police because they're afraid that if they come to the police that their immigration status will become a primary issue. And so for me, immigration reform starts with a pathway to citizenship. In this country, we should be building bridges and not walls. Assimilation starts with an open arm, right? We should welcome those people into this country in the same way that our immigrant forefathers were welcomed into these communities, sometimes in the case of the Finns up on the range, maybe not as much, but I digress. My Finnish friend here. But we should be welcoming these people into our country because it's that way that we'll go stronger in this process. By welcoming people in, they'll become part of the American family and the American fabric. But if we put our arms up, if we build walls, if we tell these people that they're not welcome here, or that if they are here, that they don't have access to the same rights and processes that we do, then we'll never fix this problem. We need a pathway to citizenship in this country.
Thank you. This round of questioning will start with Ms. Pfeiffer. There are 500,000 people experiencing homelessness in the United States today. How will you address this problem?
First off, I feel very, very strongly about one of the answers here, so I'm going to cede 30 seconds of this answer to just address the border wall issue. I spent 6 years chronicling and documenting stories of immigrants who crossed the border to get here. Many of them, some of them, came here to smuggle drugs or human trafficking, and I can assure you that a border wall is absolutely the worst idea to address criminals trying to cross our border. So I just want to get that out of the way, first of all. When it comes to homelessness, I think the best thing that we can do is empower our communities. Homelessness has a unique face in every community, and we need to empower those communities to address the issue in their own unique ways. So I am a big proponent of community block grants that can go to nonprofit organizations working throughout the 8th District and the country to help address the crisis that the country is experiencing in affordable housing. Furthermore, we also need to make sure we are raising the minimum wage in this country. There is nowhere in this country where you can work full-time at minimum wage and afford a one-bedroom apartment. Nowhere. If you are working full-time, you should be able to put a roof over your family's head. So I am a strong supporter in the fight for 15 to make sure that we can raise the minimum wage over 5 years to $15 an hour. Thank you.
A lot of our homeless people are our veterans. The thing that this country can do, and we do it really good, is create veterans. We send them off to war. When they come home, we really don't do a good job in meeting their needs, whether it is addressing their health issues when they come home or their mental health issues as a result of their service. We have to start taking care of our veterans. They swore to protect us. We have to have their backs now. There are several good local programs that are helping to devise places for these veterans to live and to meet their needs. We need to expand that nationwide. We have kids in this community right now who are literally couch surfing because of the situations in their homes, their runaways. We need to reach out and create beds, safe housing for our kids. We can do that, but again, it takes money, it takes grants, block grants that are sent into communities, and it has to be the people who are on the ground dealing with these situations, talking to these kids, talking to the veterans. We can't have mandates from the federal government, but we can provide these block grants to the people on the ground who know how to address these situations and make sure that people are finding their homes. And it also goes back to good jobs and those $15 an hour starting jobs. So we can do this. We just have to be smart about it. Thank you.
Having worked in the city of Duluth for 22 years, I faced and watched homeless people of all ages on the streets of Duluth, and it was a tragedy. What we have to do is really offer them, give them the opportunity for a good job, and make sure that if they are addicted to drugs, that we get them the treatment they need. And if they are experiencing a mental health crisis or dual diagnosis, drugs and alcohol, we need to get them the help they need so they can get back up on their feet and contribute to society. A lot of times we have the ability to do that. In the police department, we hired, and I was one of the decision makers, we hired a social worker for the first time. We hired a social worker to get into the homeless folks and try and get them the help they need to succeed in life, and I'm very proud of that. I'm proud of the Duluth Police Department's efforts. We did that in conjunction with St. Louis County's Public Health and Human Services. So as long as there's a will for us to help, there's a way, and I look forward to putting forth programs that make sure that homelessness is reduced on a steady basis.
Homelessness is a national tragedy. There's no reason in this great country of ours that there should be homelessness. And I tie that homelessness, why there's so much homelessness going on in this country, is because we cannot have a living wage. And therefore, if a person cannot have a living wage, they lose their house, they lose their car sometimes, they live on the streets because that's the only thing that if they are working, that they can afford. All the block grants, all the programs, the money is being siphoned off. If we can redirect some of that money and subsidies that they're given to the oil corporations, the military, and all these, we can get those 500,000 people homes. We can get them the help they need. We can do all these things, but it takes commitment. So many times I walk these streets out here and I see the homeless. But I see other people just turn and ignore them, their plight, their desperation. We can turn all this around, and when I'm elected, that is one of the issues that is on the table there to try to get that. We can do all these things, but we need to start seeing them. Thank you.
We should all in this country want someone to have a roof over their heads. I think that's something we can all agree on. And homelessness has a lot of faces, and one of them is actually mine. And I was at a point in my life where my dad and I weren't getting along. I had made some poor decisions, and my friend and I lost our apartment. We were too proud to call home, and we ended up couch surfing. And then that fell apart. So we ended up sleeping in a car in the middle of the winter while we were going to Mesabi Range Community College. It was tough. We actually ran out of gas one night trying to keep warm. And my friend's mom came to give us a little bit of diesel fuel. I had an Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme. It was pretty good at idling. But we didn't plan far enough ahead. And it's why in the legislature, I sat on the committee where we addressed it with Representative Karen Clark and actually invested into affordable housing for communities, block grants, and trying to make sure that the housing stock around our state, especially in rural communities, is up to spec and that there's programs that we have that can invest into improving them. And I'll close with single-payer health care would probably stop more homelessness because there are more bankruptcies in this country from people who get sick, and that's wrong.
So it's been said, obviously, many times on this panel that homelessness has different faces and there are different components to it in different places, and I think that's all correct. We've seen out in Salt Lake City how they adopted a model that paired both housing resources with nonprofit support so that individual cases could be dealt with to meet their best needs, whether it was drug addiction or whether it was a short-term homelessness issue or a long-term homelessness issue or whether it was a mental health issue. But here's the thing, is somebody down there said it takes commitment, and that's right. I think he's talking about the right thing. But what it really takes is money. And in order to get the money necessary to do this, then we need to shift our priorities. I remember the reason I ran for the state legislature, as I mentioned earlier, was education funding. But the reason that it had gotten so bad in Crosby-Arrington was because for 10 years at the state level, there were budget deficits every 2 years. And you know what happened? The Democrats always proposed that we should raise resources from those who could most afford it. And you know what never happened? That never happened because Republicans always had one portion, that the House or the Senate or the governor's office, and we're able to block those. And so it's easy for us to point to what the solutions are, but it seems to be that the political will to pass those solutions and to raise the resources necessary has always escaped us. And so, again, it's about priorities. We can pass tax cuts for the rich, or we can invade another country, or we can send some more bombs and missiles somewhere else, but if we're not going to make the decision to raise the resources on those who can most afford it, then we're not going to be able to do much in this country to help the people who most need it.
Thank you so much for everyone's comments tonight. I also am the face of homelessness. When I got divorced, I came back from Italy. We were a military family with 5 children. And we sold our farm, and we were without housing for a while. Luckily, our bishop let us stay in a 1-bedroom apartment above his garage. I just want you to know it was not pretty with 5 kids, but we made it through. My brother-in-law co-signed for me to get a home, or I would still be without a home today. I was able to get an education, but let's be clear, Salt Lake City is getting it right because what they say is it is cheaper to give supportive housing and housing choices and all the care a human being needs, even if they never live independently, than having someone live on the street and have to go to ER visits and not get the commitment and care they need. So first off, let's just be clear. Recently, I read that the Republicans said after they gave that big tax break to everyone but no one I know, that $400,000 a year is middle to low income. I'm in abject poverty, and everyone I know is in abject poverty. In North Branch, we put our money where our mouth is. We got the first supported living 20-bedroom apartment in our entire region and fought for it for people with long-term mental illness and people with long-term homelessness. That is a 5-county area, and that's all we could muster. Housing choices, that means affordable housing and making sure no one lives without a home.
All right, this is a question for Michelle Lee. Do you see a connection between the Polymet copper nickel sulfide mine proposal and the long-term economic and environmental sustainability of Lake Superior and the St. Louis River? How would this impact, how would this proposal rather impact your prospective constituency?
This is a tough question because this issue really sucks the air out of every room that this panel gathers to tell how they feel about things. I do not support the current proposal for copper nickel mining in a rich, water-rich environment. As a young Cub reporter, I was schooled when I came to work here in Duluth, Minnesota, that there's three legs to the economic stool of the Northland. That's timber, tourism, and taconite. I will support taconite. I will do what I can to help support that effort. It has served this area for over 100 years successfully. It has created good jobs, good paying jobs. We have a good strong union as a result. But I cannot support copper nickel mining. And let me tell you why. I am afraid that it is going to cause terrible harm, and this harm can go on for generations. Our Native American friends and neighbors tell us that water is life. I can't say it any better. We talk about our strategic reserves. Copper nickel, yes, is a strategic national reserve, but without water, we won't even need those reserves. We have to protect those. And talk about our economic security and how important our tourism industry is up here. If we spoil our water, we won't have tourism. If we spoil our water, we could have a whole generation of children who will have to move elsewhere. Water is life.
Pete Stauber. I do support the Polymet project. I want to let the science dictate the process. I want to let the process go through. It'll bring good-paying jobs to a region that needs it. It'll allow families to stay on the Iron Range and in Duluth. And I think that the strategic minerals were put in the earth for us to responsibly mine them, making sure that we keep the environment pristine and clean. And it's my opinion that we can do it, and I will support the Polymet project. And the final draft EIS has been out. The comment period's just about to end, and the experts will be making their decision shortly.
I don't support it because it is not safe. Polymet's own scientists say when it leaks, that's a 500 years of contaminated water. Other scientists will tell you it's 4,800 on the long shot part. Northern Minnesota is a great tourism place. For 350 jobs or less, why would we want to damage that or put that in jeopardy? Minnesota up here in the 8th Congressional District brings in between $200 million and $800 million per year in tourism. Is it worth it for a plant that's going to go down and close down in 25 years with automation so the jobs are not there? They will not even talk about what is the basic wage that they're going to give them employees if it comes through, and I hope to God it doesn't. But I stand against it because everything, water is life. St. Louis River, Lake Superior, that's where we get our life from. So I oppose that wholeheartedly. No Polymet.
Stewardship and sustainability has been something our parents and grandparents gave to us, and it's something that we should give to our children, too. A lot of people don't know, in the city of Virginia, where my family lives, we source our water from a reclaimed mine pit. Trout swim there. Trout live in the cleanest of waters. And I know that our family is drinking healthy water. I've got some right here tonight. And we also need to make sure that we know that steel workers in their contract, these should be organized facilities for a very specific reason. The first part of their contract, they have the ability, without fear of losing their job, to report any environmental concern. And that's been an important thing for many generations of those workers. Our kids also need the tools to do better. That's why in my first term I carried a bill to create a water research center, an extension of the University of Minnesota, so that our kids have the resources to find the next mitigation processes that they need to do things a little bit better than us. We need to invest in the science and technologies to make sure that our kids can tackle tomorrow's problems.
So my position on both copper-nickel projects is basically the same. I don't think that juxtaposing jobs versus the environment is a decision we should have to make. It's a false choice and one that, frankly, in the future will be less and less pertinent as technology and mechanization displace working people. However, I'd like to think I'm as ethical a consumer as I can be, and the issue is that I believe we should move aggressively away from fossil fuels. We should do so perhaps by implementing higher and higher renewable standards and looking at how we regulate carbon emissions. But the paradox is that as we do so, we're going to need more precious metals. They're in the solar cells and the wind turbines and your electric cars and everywhere we go. And so the issue that we have to wrestle with is, what does ethical consumption mean in that way? We should do more to increase our recycling. There's no doubt about it. But even if we increase recycling, 80% of the copper ever mined is available for recycling still. Even if we do that, we still can't meet the demand. And so where exploration or drilling is necessary, we have to have a clear process that's science-based, that holds high standards in regard to what other resources might be impacted. And if a project can't be done safely, then it shouldn't be permitted. However, I have to be able to rely on our agencies, the MPCA, the DNR, the Forestry Service, and others, to tell me that. If there's a project that's approved, we should have financial assurances set aside to clean up after the life of the mine, after the life of the company potentially. Those should be bankruptcy-proof resources. And we should increase inspections so that during the construction and operation of that mine, it's done exactly as they've laid out in those specifications. A different position, in my opinion, is not necessarily ethical, because that those minerals will come from another place on Earth where those same standards may not be in place.
Thank you. Mining. We don't have any in North Branch, I want you to know, but we have a lot in our district. We also have a lot in Norway, and timber, and oil exploration. I'm sure you know that. The permitting process, because right now, as we all know, we have a president of the United States that basically is gutting anything to do with climate change or good climate policy or permitting. We have a state that has to give permits to companies that want to do business here and to go in and explore our natural resources. We also have miners that need to put food on their tables. I am not someone who is going to say, yes, all environment, no to jobs. We have to get this right. As was mentioned earlier, we have to get this right because we have a responsibility. I am unwilling to put it on kids in another country that have no protections. I want to get it right, and that means in the permitting process that it has explicit language, best practices, scientifically based, inclusive of everyone at a table. There are countries that actually have commissions, mining companies, miners, environmentalists, activists, scientists, and technologists. They work together. I have said before, like I do in my own city, I will be up here with my waders on, testing the water weekly if that's what it takes. Money up front. Money up front. Development must pay for itself. If someone wants to come here and explore, they pay for it.
As I mentioned earlier, my family has benefited from the taconite mining industry in the Iron Range for four generations. My parents met up in Ely while my dad was working at Reserve, and when he was laid off in 81, they moved to Duluth so he could work at St. Mary's Hospital. He worked there for about 5 years, and as soon as North Shore Mining called and said they were reopening the plant in Silver Bay, he dropped St. Mary's and he went back to work at North Shore. because they're good jobs. Taconite mining has provided a lifeline for this region for many, many years. But let's be very clear. Copper nickel mining is very different from taconite mining. And I am not sure there is any amount of financial assurances or this current regulatory process that could ever make me 100% comfortable with doing copper nickel mining in this water-rich environment. So in Congress, I will work to make sure that our EISs, our environmental impact statements, also include a health impact statement to make sure we are looking at all the factors that could affect our natural resources and our people. I would also work to restore financial assurances for mining companies across the country, which is a regulation that President Trump recently rolled back. I would also ensure that we are holding these multinational corporations up to high standards. Currently, the two corporations behind both PolyMet and Twin Metals have abysmal human rights records as well as environmental standards. And we need to be taking a very close look at the corporations we're inviting to do business in Minnesota.
The next question goes to Mr. Stauber. Tens of millions of Americans cannot afford to get sick or have an accident, and our overall average quality of health care ranks 37th in the world. Considering these facts, if you believe our health care system needs to be fixed, what do you believe is the best way to address problems in our system?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to put the patient and the doctor in charge of their health care and not a Washington bureaucrat to get in the middle and decide what surgeries or what medications they should get. I'll give you an example. I do not support single-payer health care. My 83-year-old father goes to the hospital on a Friday, major chest pains. He's 83. On Tuesday, he has quadruple bypass at Ascensia, recovers. At 85, he has a knee replacement at Ascensia and recovers. There is not a single-payer country in the world that would have given my father those two operations to save his life. Not one. My father, before his heart surgery, the doctor said he had 3 to 6 months to live. This is 2.5 years later. If you don't think his life matters and other seniors' lives matter, I'll beg to differ. I do think that the Obamacare and MnSure are troubling. We had Minnesota care in Minnesota that was pretty good. In fact, it was so good, other states were trying to replicate that before the Affordable Care Act came through. I want patient-driven and physician-guided health care.
I, on the other hand, support single-payer health care. It's great because it takes care of everyone. I'm looking at the homeless, the ones just living above poverty. They can't afford it. Healthcare should be a human right, not for the privileged or the ones or the individuals that can afford it. You take a look at all the programs out there now. You need a law degree to get through all that stuff. Sorry, Pete. So I support that. I take a look at Canada. Canada pays 50% less, and their life expectancy is 4 years longer than anybody here in the United States. Out of all the industrialized nations in the world, why can't we, the greatest nation in the world, take care of our people that need health care? Why can't we? And if I'm elected, I will push for that, because that's what matters. That's what matters. Everybody in this country has value.
Healthcare is a human right. I'm going to say that again. It's a human right to be healthy. And Right now, we have teachers who benefit, police, first responders from publicly subsidized health care. It's why I'm working at the legislature currently to create a regional health care center in Duluth. We need to make sure that the Northland has access to the same facilities and doctor quality of doctors, nurses, and LPNs that they do in the metro, that they do in Rochester. And it's why in Congress we need to fight for the funding so that we can have the people who took care of us be taken care of.
So let's examine the healthcare system we've come to know over these years. We've got double-digit premium increases year after year. We've got small businesses or the self-employed who can't afford the premiums. We've got small towns that have spaghetti fundraisers to pay off $100,000 medical bills. So you can get maybe like, you know, 10,000 people in the door if you're lucky, and they can all pay 10 bucks a plate, and maybe we'll get to that $100,000 or something. We've got hospital systems, for-profit care systems, aggressively expanding into the territories of one another, creating inefficiencies in our health system. This is what we've come to know. And the same party that wants to voucherize Medicare and wants to change significantly Social Security, those things that we've come to know and understand so well and that, you know, the elderly rely on, those same people are telling you that single-payer health care is not the answer. I'm telling you that this country can do better, and we know it. If we look at what care people across the rest of the world get, we know that in America we oftentimes pay twice as much or more per capita for the same care. It's absurd. It cannot go on no longer, and it creates problems across the board. So what we need to do is we need to go out there, and we need to get people in Washington, D.C., who will fight on behalf of working people, who are not afraid to challenge the drug companies, the insurance companies, those for-profit care providers, and to push aggressively for single-payer health care. We can't lag any further behind the rest of the country when it comes to this important human right.
Medicare for all. When I was in Norway recently with my father, he had a medical condition come up. And we are from Norway, and he does speak Norwegian fluently, and I just thought, how much is this going to cost me, right? So we go to the doctor. My dad just turned 80 last week, and he walks out, and there's not even a place to pay a bill. Not even a place to pay a bill. Serving in the military in Italy, one of my children had seizures. They had to see a specialist. We walked down, not a place to pay a bill. 60% of bankruptcies in America are because of health-related issues. I have constituents that lose their jobs and their home and their cars because their child needs to be up at Children's Hospital for over 100 days. And they choose being with their child and lose everything. My parents, who have worked hard their entire lives, sometimes have to choose food or their bills over going to the doctor or getting the medication they need to live. We can get this right. Drug companies are making a ton off of us. We are the only industrialized nation that pays so much for prescription drugs. It needs to be negotiated through the government. We need to have healthcare systems and healthcare access, whether you live in a metro area or you live in a rural area. And we need to get doctors to not be saddled with debt, so they want to come and work in our areas.
Like many of my fellow DFLers here, I am a strong supporter of the Medicare for All Act. But it won't take a lot more than just the Democrats to make sure that we can get Medicare for All passed. So in Congress, I will be dedicated to building a bipartisan coalition to support this act. So let's talk about why some people don't support Medicare for All. You will often hear that a Medicare for All system will bankrupt this country. And I can assure you that is absolutely not the truth. The way we can pay for Medicare for All is treating capital gains and dividends the same as we treat salary and taxing it the same way. Warren Buffett is often quoted as saying that he pays comparatively less taxes than his secretary does, because capital gains and dividends are not taxed the same as salary. We would also apply a 6% tax on healthcare premiums that would be paid for by employers, and a 2% premium that would be paid for by households. And through that combination of taxes, we would be able to easily afford the Medicare for All Act and help save Americans $6 trillion over 10 years. We can build a bipartisan coalition by talking dollars and cents with the folks across the aisle and make sure that we finally get Medicare for All passed.
I agree with the panel. Healthcare, affordable health care is a human right. Right now, the mortality among American women giving birth is rising to among the highest level in the industrial world. Think about that. I recently spoke with a doctor who told me that women up the North Shore have to drive 2 hours to have their baby delivered. Hopefully someone is driving them to get to the hospital. But think about that. We are not providing OBGYN services in all of our rural hospitals because they can't attract or afford those doctors. By providing single-payer health care with fair reimbursements to our hospitals, our rural health care system will not only survive, but will be able to thrive. The reimbursements between doctors in Duluth compared to doctors in the Twin Cities is abysmal. It's not a fair playing field. If we're going to keep good medical care here in the Northland within the 8th District in the rural areas, we're going to have to get this right. We're going to have to provide those reimbursements to our rural hospitals. I live in Moose Lake. If I have a heart attack, I don't want to have someone drive me up to Duluth or down to the Twin Cities to get critical care. My local hospital is a lifeline to my neighbors and my friends, and that's repeated across this great district. We have to get serious. We have to have single-payer health care. We have to have health care for all. End of discussion.
All right, we'll start this question with Skip Sandman. What is your position on the pro-life and pro-choice movements? And how do you foresee policy changes in these areas impacting constituents in the 8th Congressional District?
I believe it's a woman's decision. It's her body. She should have the right to say what happens to her body, to either carry a child or choose to have maybe an abortion. As a man, I can never understand that, why I should have anything to say about that issue. The impact on that is we are all individuals. I can't see a group of men trying to decide what a woman should do with their body. The Creator put that woman by a man's side, if you read the Bible, to walk, not behind, but by his side. Not the lead, not to follow behind, so that she could make her decisions to choose to stand by his side or not. And I firmly believe that is her decision. Pro-life is hers. And I know I might upset some people, like I did last time when I was asked the same question, but it's her decision.
Every woman should have the right to choose and make a decision between her and her doctor. In 6 years in the legislature, I've taken votes to that effect, making sure that we're funding clinics so that younger women and people like my wife could seek the health that they deserved from their community. Planned Parenthood was a tool that my wife and I used when she got pregnant and we had our first child. And I don't think there's anyone out there who shouldn't have that investment made in their community so that the kids and women who need those services get access to them. We need that access out there for every young woman who may end up in a difficult situation. And it's also why I carried a bill called Paid Family and Medical Leave, so that we could have more investment and have families have the opportunity to be there during those difficult times for one another. So I support a woman's right to choose, and that decision should be made between her and her doctor, no matter where they live. And we should be putting the resources out there so that wherever they do live, they can go make the best choice for them.
I support a woman's right to choose. I think that decision should be left to her and the people that she chooses to include in that decision. I also think, as my friend Jason had mentioned, that we should include increased support services for people who are young parents, including paid parental leave, as well as WIC and other programs that help make sure that the children born in this country are raised healthy and have access to the opportunities that everybody in this country should.
First of all, I just want to thank all the men for saying that it is a women's right. I'm a woman. Thank you for giving us that right. This is a decision as a mom of five children that was raised them in a very, LDS environment. Pro-choice and anti-choice. I often have discussions with people and talk about if you really want that child to be born, what do we do? Are you pro-life or pro-birth? Because it's a discussion we need to have. I would love to have fewer abortions. How do we get that? With access, free access to health care anywhere for any woman. I have sisters. I come from a large family. Some of them are 16 years older than me. They had to go to unsafe places, in unsavory places, sometimes not America, to have abortions. That is not okay. We need safe reproductive care. My sister Katrina will often say, and she'll say it now, she's in her 50s now, she would not have had health care had it not been for Planned Parenthood. I don't know how we have demonized access for women to health care. I don't know how it is in the decision makers that are mostly men making decisions about my body or my daughter's body. It needs to stop. We need to open our minds and be honest about what we're doing. There is a reason that the state and religion are separate. Let's keep it that way.
One of the guiding factors in my decision to run for Congress was the image of a table full of men making decisions about my health care, about women's health care. We all remember that very, very powerful image. Ever since Roe v. Wade, women's right to choose has been under attack, but never more so than under this administration. And let's be very clear. Pro-choice policies are pro-life policies. We need to make sure that this anti-choice administration is laid bare for what it is. They are not trying to limit abortion. They are trying to limit a woman's right to her own economic and reproductive well-being. And every policy that has been issued out of this administration proves that. So we need strong women in Congress, especially women, standing up for their right to choose. And as Kirsten said, we need to make sure that we keep abortion safe, accessible, and rare through always fighting for Planned Parenthood, for reproductive support services, and making sure that no woman ever has to make the horrifying decisions that Kirsten was talking about earlier, going to unsavory places, places that put their life and their family's lives at risk. And in Congress, I will fight to make sure that that stays a right for all women.
Abortion is the law of the land. The issue of abortion should be between a woman and her doctor. The government should not be making decisions on this level. Planned Parenthood is essential. It provides many women with the health care they need, whether it is birth control or reproductive care. Federal funds should go to continue supporting Planned Parenthood. When I was 8 months pregnant with my son, who is now 31 years old, I had a blood clot in my lung. It was really touch and go. And Dr. Peter Bartson, after he delivered my son, he came to my husband and me and he says, "Don't you two ever do this again. because you will not survive a next pregnancy. Believe me, we were very happy to have access to birth control. And every woman should be able to have access to that. And the matter of abortion, it should be, I'll bring it back, it's between a woman and her doctor. Government should not be messing with this. Government should not have a place in making this decision. It's up to the woman.
Looks like I'm the only pro-life candidate in the room. I believe life begins at conception and ends at natural death.
Thank you. We have time for only one more question, and this has been submitted from the floor. This is not from the students. Let me put it, and I'll start with Mr. Metza. We'll start all over again, but you'll all get a chance to respond, of course. So we start with Mr. Metza. Regarding redistricting, given that the next U.S. Census will be in 2020, is an independent commission the best way to guarantee fair elections in the future? And if so, how do you believe such a commission should be formed? What is the criteria? What are the criteria for members? And if not, what do you suggest for 2020?
Having fair representation in this country is something we all deserve. There's a couple cases right now that are going to be coming up before the Supreme Court in regard to gerrymandering. We have literally drawn the lines to get the politics that the base of a specific party wants, and that's wrong. Minnesota actually has a pretty good system, and it's landed into the hands of our courts each time, where it's drawn based on school district lines and natural community, I guess, links, essentially. So communities with similarities are put together. And gerrymandering in this country has been one of the things that has ruined our politics. And so I think that we need to make sure that if there's not a resolution through the Supreme Court right now, that we go change the law so that people get fair representation from their government. Because if we don't, we're going to see the hyper-partisan politics continue. I remember when I was young being able to sit back and go, people invested in education, in transportation, and in moving the ball forward for the next generation. And right now, if we add a hole outside the Minnesota State Office building in our parking lot, and every legislator on their way home from work hit that, knocked their car out of alignment, we'd argue for 2 years on how to fix it. That's not fair to you.
So I want to start broadly and say that our political system is broken. And gerrymandering is just one symptom of it. Here in the state of Minnesota, we actually, you know, I generally agree with my friend on most things, but we actually don't have a good system. It's just that we've been lucky it's ended up in the courts each time. It's actually a very high-stakes system where if the legislature and the governor were in alignment, if they were all Democrats or if they were all Republicans, then they would draw the lines and they would pass the lines. What has happened is that deadlock has then turned this process over to the courts here in Minnesota, and so we've gotten fair results over the last several decades. However, that's a proposition that we can't afford to gamble on in the future. So I do support an independent commission. But more importantly, what I support is campaign finance reform, because I think that that is the root issue. It's intractable, and it delays our ability to make progress in so many other areas. I managed Congressman Nolan's campaign in 2016. It was a campaign we won by less than 1 point when Donald Trump won this district by 16 points. It also happened to be the most expensive congressional race ever run to that point. It cost $30 million in the northeastern Minnesota congressional district. $30 million. Consider what we could have done with $30 million other than throw it onto the TV airwaves to slander one another, right? And so if we don't get this issue right, we face a really big problem in the future. I am the first candidate in this race to agree to sign N Citizens United pledge to not accept any corporate PAC money. I think that we need to have a Congress that's beyond reproach, and we need to be able to know that the people really are in power in this country.
Thank you so much. I am the second person in this race to sign the N Citizens United. Money needs to be out of politics. There is no reason a candidate who raises the most money wins. Norway, I'll take us back to Norway for a moment, has a great system. I want publicly funded elections. Every candidate gets the same amount of money. You want to spend it attacking someone else? Your money is gone. We also need a shorter election cycle, 6 months. Finally, if we take the money out of politics, the people in Washington will not go across the street on their breaks to call to raise money. They'll be able to work governing. Money needs to get out of politics. Gerrymandering is a symptom. It is not the root cause. We take the money out. We let everyone be counted in the census. We allow open voting. Anyone 18 and older is registered to vote. Let's make our one person, one vote.
I hope to be the third person to sign this pledge. Sue, can you text me the link, maybe? So I absolutely agree with my counterparts here. We immediately need to pass a constitutional amendment to end Citizens United. There's legislation pending in the House to that effect, and there's absolutely no reason that we should not be having hearings and votes on this legislation. There are two other pieces of legislation that are pending that would help create a partially publicly funded campaign finance system that it could help end the corrosive effects of super PACs and special interest money in our elections. And speaking to the redistricting question, we absolutely need an independent commission. Here in Minnesota, we are going to be very affected by the results of the 2020 census. We could lose our fighting eighth. So if we go down to just seven representatives, it is going to be more important than ever to make sure we have fair lines drawn that are truly representative of the people who live in Minnesota.
The 8th District is over 27,000 square miles. We have hundreds of thousands of people in this district, and I would hate to see redistricting take away the fighting 8th, because we would lose so much, and the voice of the people in our rural communities would be lost. Citizens United is, we have to get rid of that. I am just learning as a new candidate just how difficult it is to raise money and what all of these candidates are being asked to do. Up to 30 hours a week calling strangers and asking for donations to further our campaigns. There's something wrong with this. We should be out talking to those people, hundreds of thousands of people in our district, learning what their issues are, coming together, coming around a table and figuring out how we can resolve things about the problems with our rural health care problems and our opioid addictions and how we can address the problems that we face every day. But no, instead, we have candidates sitting in rooms and lawmakers in Washington sitting in rooms calling because they have to support their next election. We need publicly funded campaigns. We need shorter campaigns so that people, and we have to tear down the walls preventing people from voting. We need everyone to cast their ballots, everyone to be making an informed decision on who their best person is to represent them in Washington. I'm out of time. I could go on. I'm always doing 10 words when two are needed. I apologize.
Candidate Leo, yield some more time if you'd like, if you wanted to finish a statement.
Were you done?
I just want to encourage everyone to get registered to vote and vote in the primary if there is one and vote in the general election in November. Do your due diligence. Learn about each and every one of these candidates up there because it's going to be up to you to send the best person to Washington. Thank you. Thank you for the time,
You're
Pete.
Welcome. It's been mentioned that the redistricting is become extremely political, and that's unfortunate. And I think that's why the elected public servants get a bad name. They try to gerrymander lines that follow their political persuasion rather than natural boundaries or school districts or what have you. So I think this is a big issue, and I want it to be as fair as possible, and I'm not so sure that we need the elected officials in. I think that we could look at it and try and find an impartial group of folks to do it. And then when that result comes forward, I think that we all can agree that it wouldn't be gerrymandering, and the decision would be in the best interest of the voters.
Gerrymandering
You know, it's a Supreme Court decision. And what we need to do is pressure those esteemed gentlemen to take this issue up. The other thing we need to do, and I'll agree with that, the other candidates here, we need to get rid of Citizens United. We need to take the big money out of politics. We need to have, in the donation process, anybody that gives more than $200 to a candidate, their name, their address, where they work at. Level the playing field. Too many times, the third party candidates, and I'm talking about myself, is playing on a tilted table. The two main parties out there try to dominate everything. And that's what makes this great country great, is a level playing field. Some of the parties will say, don't talk to that individual because he's not in our party. And if both parties are getting the money from the same corporations, what's your choice? Gerrymandering? No. Should not happen. Because it's politically motivated. Thank you.
All right, so that is the end of questioning. We're drawing our time to a close here. So what we'll do now is that we're going to invite all of our candidates to share some closing remarks. And that will be 1 minute. And then after they're done with their closing remarks, Dr. Morgan will invite us all to a post-forum gathering that's happening somewhere where I can't tell you where it is, but he can. This is his campus, not mine. So we'll begin with the closing remarks. 1 minute, please. And we'll start with candidate Sandman, please.
Well, I want to thank you for inviting me here today. And you know my positions. I don't sit on a fence on issues. What is the best for the people? Because you're the ones that are going to put me in office. I'm not going to go there to rub elbows with someone. I'm not going to go there to make friends or line my own pockets. I'm there for you. I'm there for you. Why? Because you have value. I'll never try lying to you, but I'll be straight up and honest. If I support an issue, I support an issue. If I don't, I'll let you know. I won't blow smoke at you. And if you want to read more about it, please visit my website, skipsandman.com. Thank you.
Pete Stauber. Thank you very much to the students at both UMD and Scholastica for putting this on, and the moderator's timekeeper. This has been very informative to the other candidates. I appreciate being on stage with all of you. As we look into this campaign season, I'm excited. I really believe that our best days are yet to come. And the greatest generation handed us a wonderful country. I think it's our responsibility to pass that baton to the young generation in better shape. This country should be in better shape. And I think that my goal as your congressman is to represent everybody firm, fair, and impartial, just like I did as a police officer for the city of Duluth. This is an extension of my public service, serving 8 years on the Hermantown City Council, now second term as a county commissioner. I look forward to the continued campaign and the support. Thank you.
Michelle Lee. Thanks again to the sponsors for this opportunity to share my story with you. And again, mine is just one of hundreds of thousands of stories here in this district. I want you to know that I hear you, and I will use my skills to give voice, your voice, in Washington. I support Minnesota values and the DFL platform, and we have the strongest state here in the nation because we believe in common sense, gun reform, health care as a basic human right, access to educational opportunities, good-paying, sustainable jobs, protecting the dignity and earned benefits of our senior citizens and our veterans. We believe in collective bargaining, protection of our hard-earned pensions, protection against predatory lending. I will fight to protect all voters' rights. I will not waver in my support of these values. This is my first ever campaign. You can believe me when I say I promise you I will never put special interests before your interests. I will go, so if I'm so lucky to go to Washington, I will go there to do the people's business. Thank you very much for allowing me to share a few of my ideas with you tonight. Thank you.
Leah Pfeiffer, thank you again so much to our forum sponsors and to everyone who joined us tonight. Nearly 10 years ago, I raised my right hand and I swore an oath to protect this country, to protect our national security. But the reason that I am sitting here today and not back in my office at the FBI is because the greatest threat to our national security is sitting in the Oval Office. I have spent the past 10 years in immigration enforcement and counterterrorism, and I can tell you that travel bans and border walls do not constitute national security. Our national security is built on food and housing security for every single family, equal access to quality health care and quality education. So I will continue my public service in national security by fighting for those values for every American.
Kirsten Kennedy, as with everyone, I'm so grateful and humbled to be here tonight. What a great country. What an ideal we have as America. And right now, as my father says, we're reminding him of when the Nazis invaded in Norway when he was 2 and when they left. That's not the America that he wants his children to live in or his grandchildren to live in or future generations. So let's be clear. There is a middle class that has disappeared. We need Medicare for all. We need to invest in infrastructures, not walls. Immigrations, we need to get it right. We need to welcome them because, as with most people here, I am not indigenous. We need to protect our environment and bring good jobs and green jobs. We need to work at diplomacy instead of never-ending wars. We need to bring our soldiers home, and we need to take care of them and protect them. We need to recognize we are an aging population. We can get this right.
Joe Radinovich, I want to make it short here and thank everybody who's come tonight. And I also want to just say, like, me too to, like, most of what was said here, except for Pete, all right? Pete, we disagree on some things. And that's cool. That's cool. I like you anyway. But here's the thing is I got in this race because we're facing a radically changing economy. People are being displaced by technology and mechanization in the mines, in the farms, factories, grocery stores, everywhere across this economy. And what's happening is that people who used to be able to go out of high school and get a job to support themselves and their family are losing that ability. I think that a lot of people know that work is more than just a job. It's about your ability to take care of the people around you. There are some people in this country who would have us believe that our best days are behind us, that we can simply go back in time where we can make ourselves great again. I'm here to tell you that we have to go forward. And the way we're going to go forward is with those same values that served us well before. We're going to invest in child care, we're going to invest in education, we're going to invest in health care, because it's the people of this country that matter the most, and they deserve to have somebody fighting for them in Washington, D.C. That's what I'm hoping to do, and I hope to have your support. Thank you.
Jason Metza. Well, again, thank you all for being here, and I'll repeat, it's been great to have all of you candidates up here, too. We have a lot of good people to choose from, but we've also got some stark differences among us. Washington needs a fighter. I've been a fighter in St. Paul for the last 6 years for things like raising the minimum wage, carrying paid family and medical leave, and making sure that we have security for women at work. I think in St. Paul, we need to fight for those things too. And when we're talking about rolling up our sleeves and working hard, that's something I know about. I've done it my whole life. I'm willing to go do it in Washington for you. And we need to be standing up for what's right, not what's popular. I've done that my entire tenure in the legislature. And if you give me the opportunity, I will do it for you in Washington.
Now you can clap. Don't go yet, though. Thank you all for coming, and thank you all 7 candidates. You were, all 7 of you, quite articulate and very persuasive, impressive. I just have to say to the audience that this whole event was 100% student produced.
And, yeah, let's give them a round of applause.